Wait, can I interject?
Yeah.
Can I ask, did you watch iCarly, like, back in the day?
Yeah.
So they put that on Netflix.
Yeah.
So I started to rewatch it, and it just made me think of when you're talking about, like, teenage sex scenes, of, like, the fact that it's adults that are writing what the children say. And in the first episode, it's, like, so cheesy watching it going back, but, like, at the end, so they, like, do their little web show, and they have a party at the end where they're wearing weird hats, mm-hmm. and, like, the teenage boys that are, like, oh, so cute, they, like, come up to the girls, and they're, like, do you want to dance? And, or, like, they said something about, I don't know if it was the girls said that they were hot, or, like, they said the girls were hot, they were, like, yeah, it's pretty hot, and they're, like, let's go dance. And to me, I was just thinking that there were adults, like, sitting around writing this dialogue for children to say to each other.
Yeah.
Which is, that's weird to me. That's, like...
No, for sure. I mean, anytime I watch shows with, like, teenagers, I always notice, I'm like, who says things like that? And it'll be them using some weird form of slang that was a thing, like, 25 years ago. And I'm like, I don't think kids today talk like this, but...
Oh, my gosh, no. Yeah, like, did you watch Drake and Josh back in the day?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Great show, but I don't know if I talk about this on the podcast before, but there was, like, the one episode where there was, like, a magician guy, and he, like, needed a place to crash for a couple of nights, I guess, so the grown adult man musician stayed in Drake and Josh's bedroom in their house, and, like, he had to have, like, a CPAP machine, or it was, like, this whole thing, which, like, I didn't question as a kid how freaking weird that is. Like, if you had a strange man staying in your home and you let them stay in your teenage son's bedroom?
Yeah, no, I don't even remember that. But TV back then, 100... I mean, even before that, I watched this video on YouTube, and it was just... It was, like... a ton of, it was something like 10 adult jokes that were in the Rugrats.
And there's so many, like, adult jokes and, like, children stuff.
Yeah. And some of, like, the more clean ones would, like, I guess, the dad Stew wouldn't stop showing them the home videos. And so the grandfather, like, pretends to have a heart attack, and nobody, like, they're like, stop it, you're not having a heart attack. He was just trying to get out of having to watch more home videos. And so he picks up the phone and he's like, hello, Dr. Kevorkian, I have a job for you. And, you know, Dr. Kevorkian was someone who was helping his patients, like, commit suicide. So just like, wow.
That's weird. That's weird.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Pink Collar Crime, a true crime podcast focusing exclusively on crimes committed by women. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Natalie. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome.
Each week, we're going to tell you about one or two cases of crimes committed by women and discuss details, motives, similarities, and differences, etc., etc.
If you like our show, tell your friends. Please subscribe and give us a 5-star rating and tell us what you love or don't love about the show.
And give us a follow on social media at pinkcollar_pod.
But yeah, so rate, comment, or review, follow us. You know the drill, guys. Thanks. And yeah, every review, we're going to be donating $1 to the National Center of Victims of Crimes. And so we have a few now, so we can definitely do, if you're, I don't know how much you want to wait till 20, like, bucks or something.
Yeah, 20. Maybe we could just do it and say we did it.
Yeah.
Although I did just drop a lot of money on tattoos.
We'll wait till the next payday. We'll wait till the next payday. It's all good.
Maybe wait till that stimulus check comes.
Can't wait. So yeah, this week our topic is Rachel's awesome idea of couples. So at least one person being a woman within the couple committing a crime. So that's what we're getting into. Just to preface, I chose this case because I think it brought up just a very kind of interesting situation in which it is a couple who's involved in a murder, but the reasons for the complicity of the woman, in my opinion, are questionable. And so my case is of Edith Thompson. And so getting right into it, born on Christmas in 1893, Edith Jessie Graydon was the oldest of five. She was raised in London, England, and Edith was known to be a very happy girl who was as talented as she was smart. She shined in dancing and acting and naturally excelled in what a source called arithmetic, which for us Americans, that's just math. And so by 16, Edith left school and began working in the clothing industry. Not long after, she developed a reputation of being stylish, intelligent, and extremely capable at her job, eventually getting promoted to chief buyer for Carlton and Pryor, which is or was some sort of like fashionable women's hat company. So good for her. Also around the age of 15 and 16, in 1909, Edith met Percy Thompson, who was 18 years old at the time. They soon became engaged and were married in 1916 after a six-year engagement. In 1920, the couple became acquainted with 18-year-old Frederick Byers. Edith was about 27 or 28 at the time, and although this was the first time Percy had become acquainted with him, Edith had actually met Frederick almost a decade prior because Frederick was actually one of her little brother's school friends, and so that means he was like about 9 years old when she first met him. And so now at 18, Frederick was a ship's steward in the Merchant Navy. I assume a merchant navy is like a navy. I don't know. I don't know exactly what it. It's a military. Can't tell you, right? I don't know. And so, Frederick is described as being handsome and impulsive. Due to his line of work, Frederick had been able to travel to different parts of the world, and his stories of his travels captivated Edith, who pretty immediately developed an attraction for Frederick. Unlike her husband, Percy, who was described as being serious, dull, and very conventional, Frederick more closely resembled Edith's ideal romantic partner. Of course, Percy was unaware of his wife's feelings for Frederick, so he was actually very welcoming of Frederick and considered him like a family friend at that point. The couple didn't have any children. Percy even invited Frederick on vacation, or as the Brits say, on holiday.
I love that they say that.
For a while when I was younger, it confused me. I was like, what holiday was it? Percy invited Frederick on vacation with he and Edith and then Edith's sister to the Isle of Wight. And even after they returned from the trip, because Frederick had some time before he had to ship back out with the Merchant Navy.
Whatever they might do. Boats, something with boats.
Yeah. And so Percy invited Frederick to stay with them, until he needed to leave. And so by the following year, Edith and Frederick were in a full-on affair. Of course, Percy figured out what was going on and confronted both of them. Frederick and Percy got into a bit of a scuffle Frederick and Percy got into a bit of a scuffle, and because Frederick had all of the nerve and audacity of a dumb teenager, he literally demanded that Percy divorce his wife so that he could be with Edith and marry her instead. And so I'm just like, who do you think you are to like tell someone like you need a divorce, like your wife? Also, side note, as I'm looking at my script, it looks like instead of Percy, in a lot of cases, I write pervy. So those C and V are like right next to each other on.
Did not give you like a red squiggly line, although I guess pervy is a word.
Pervy is a word. So, yeah, let's do this. And so, of course, jeez. I'm keeping that one in. I'm keeping that little flub in. So, of course, Percy kicked Frederick, like, the heck out of his house. Later, Edith described getting into a very violent altercation with Percy. She said that right after Frederick left, Percy was very angry, which, you know, I don't think is surprising, and I'm not going to fault someone for being mad finding out that their, like, partner is having an affair with someone they considered a friend or in general. But Percy's anger went beyond just yelling. Percy hit Edith in the face several times and threw her across the room in his fit of rage. Yeah, no matter how angry you are.
Like, just leave. Just walk away.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. I feel like the only cases where hitting someone is, like, justifiable is if you are defending yourself or, I don't know, if they took the crown off of your head on The Bachelor. Anyway, still, Edith was enamored with Frederick, who had left with the Merchant Navy for a year-long expedition at sea. And so he was gone from September 1921 to September 1922. During that time, Edith wrote over 60 love letters to Frederick detailing her life, feelings, memories. She would tell him about, like, things that she was reading, just kind of, like, any thought or imagination or anything that she had, she would just write in letters and keep him kind of abreast of her life. And so although Edith and Percy went back to business as usual in regard to their relationship, when Frederick got back, the affair between he and Edith resumed. And so, as a reminder, Frederick is a very impulsive guy. That, combined with his age, you know, frontal lobe not being developed yet, and being, I'm going to say, irrationally in love with a married woman who he believed to be miserable with her husband, was kind of a recipe for disaster. And so a month after he got back, so it was early October 1922, Edith and Percy had gone out on just a nice little date, you know, a nice little outing to the theater, as, you know, Brits are apt to do.
I think it's pronounced theater.
The theater. And so they were in central London. They had to take, like, a train. They got back to, like, where they lived from the train. And so they were walking back home. And a man jumped out from behind some bushes and attacked Percy with a knife. Edith was terrified and screamed, "No, don't," multiple times during the attack. Different reports say she was screaming, "Oh, no," "Oh, don't," things like that. Either way, she was terrified and kind of pleading for this person to, like, not hurt them. In the scuffle, Edith was, like, thrown to the ground. And Percy, he held his own for a while, but he was eventually stabbed. And so Percy died on the sidewalk before help even got there. The attacker had gotten away, but not before Edith had a chance to see his face. It was Frederick.
Saw that one coming.
Yep. And so once the police arrived, Edith told them everything, including naming her lover, Frederick Bywaters, as the man who violently murdered her husband. Not only that, Edith told them how she knew Frederick, but as far as I can tell, I don't think she told them, like, the full capacity, like, of their relationship. And so police conducted an investigation of Frederick, which soon led to them arresting him on the charge of murdering Percy Thompson. As they searched Frederick's belongings, they discovered the 60-plus love letters that Edith had written to Frederick while at sea. To the police, the love letters were evidence of Edith's complicity in the murder of Percy. The letters were the only evidence that they had for linking Edith to the attack. However, as far as I can tell, nothing in the letters said, "Yo, boo, I want you to murder my husband." Okay?
Seriously.
Like, nothing said that in the letters. But I will get into some other things where they're like, "See, she's a bad person." Basically, investigators believe that the letters allowed for something called the consideration of common purpose. And so common purpose in this sense mean that if two people want, like, a third person to someone else to die, and there's a, I think the,
sounds like a helicopter.
I think the Air Force is doing their stupid thing, like, where they just fly around. Whatever. I'm not gonna edit that part out either. Whatever. And so, live action. And so, as I was saying, so common purpose in the sense means that if two people want, like, a third person, so someone else to die, and one of the two people acts on that desire, then both people are equally guilty.
That's stupid.
Very stupid, and I see a lot of flaws in that kind of way of thinking, but
it's one thing if they were plotting together and one person carried out the act.
Yeah. Yeah.
With the plan that they came up with together. But if one person's just like, "God, I hate this person. I wish they were dead." And the other person just takes that and runs with it. Mm-hmm. I don't think that other person is to blame.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think that, very flawed here. So because of the common purpose nonsense, Edith was arrested, and they both were charged with the murder of Percy Thompson. So in December of 1922, the trial began, and Frederick was very cooperative with the investigators. He led them to the murder weapon. He fully explained, like, what his thought process was that day, and, like, what basically his plan, like, what he was trying to do. And he insisted that Edith had nothing to do with the attack, and she didn't know what he was planning to do. Still, the officers believed that Edith's letters were evidence that she wanted her husband dead. So basically what was written in the letters, so of course Edith was, like, you know, vehemently and, like, passionately declaring her love for Frederick and that she didn't want to be with her husband, or she wanted to be free of Percy. She also wrote something about grinding up a light bulb into small shards and, like, mixing them into mashed potatoes and, like, feeding them to her husband. And then
that's
weird. As, like, I guess as a means of murder.
Would that even kill a person?
I don't know.
If they were ground up small enough, they wouldn't puncture your, like, intestines.
Yeah. And she also wrote about, like, putting poison in food. Either way, like, clearly nothing had happened to Percy. And so there is a question of, like, whether or not, like, she actually did those things, or if it was just writing. So if she did do those things, clearly Percy survived them. Basically, she also wrote that she was just, like, desperate to be, like, free of Percy. And so I think her writing, like, that she was desperate to be free of him, I think that that is what prosecutors took and kind of ran with and been like, "See, like, that means she wanted her lover to go to desperate means." It was a stretch. It was truly a stretch in my opinion.
It was a stretch, but also considering that she was writing all of these ways that she was thinking about murdering him, that makes me feel like she is heading in the direction of being more complicit.
Yeah.
Because if she was saying, I am planning to do these things, or I would like to do these things, then she is crossing that line. It's one thing if she's just saying, like, I don't want to be married to this person anymore, I'd like to be free, and then that's that. But if she's escalating it to the point of, here's what I'd like to do, then I can see where they would have an argument there.
So I get that too, and I don't disagree, but I will say that I feel like the case is stronger if she's like, oh, I, you know, like, thought of poisoning him, and then Frederick poisoned Percy.
True.
Like,
true.
I think it's like, even if she wrote that, hey, I fed him poison, I think because nothing happened to him, that is not a crime. Like, it is a crime. It is a crime, but I'm saying it's not a crime that they can prove. Yes, it's not. Then. It's not something that they can prove, and so it's just words on a paper, on a piece of paper. Now, if she'd written, you know, I put shards of glass in his food, it didn't work, and next thing you know, like, Frederick becomes a chef at his favorite restaurant and is putting light bulbs in all of his meals. Like, again, that's a different situation. But yeah, I do think for the most part, even though there's like slight circumstantial things going on, all they have are these letters. There is nothing else.
Yeah, or even if she said, oh, I wish that he would just get like attacked, or like, how wonderful it would be if some random...
If there was just a random act of violence, yeah.
Right. In that case, it's a gray area for mm-hmm. me.
Yeah. I'm going to pause and save. So her lawyers at the trial, her lawyers told her that it was best that she not take the stand. So their kind of thinking or rationale for that is that the burden of proof for proving that she was somehow involved or complicit was fully on the prosecution. And so by her taking the stand, it gives them more opportunity to either poke holes in what she's saying or just make her a less sympathetic defendant. And so they're
generally
like,
too, I feel like they don't, all lawyers will encourage people not to go on the stand. I feel like in almost every case, that's okay. Like very, very common.
Okay, good to know. So yeah, they were like, don't do it. But given the nature of the case, like, it became really sensationalized in the news and the media. Like, people were kind of like, whoa, like, you know, here's a case of like an affair gone wrong, or thinking, oh, look at this like young guy who was just so in love with this woman that he did, you know, this horrible thing just to be with her. It was lots of mixed kind of opinions on what was going on, but people were captivated. Also, did they have TV back then? I'm gonna say no. So this was entertainment, guys.
They didn't have Netflix, like,
that's basically, I feel like I say that every episode, like, they don't, if you don't have TV, I feel like that leads to more crime.
I mean, the crime rate has been going down. Maybe it's because of Netflix. Oh my god, make that your next research study.
I should.
When people have good TV, they just commit less crime because...
I mean, like, I do believe that, especially in the case of, like, crimes committed, like, way back when, because a lot of it just seems like they were doing... Like, I feel like I see a lot of people just doing crime for sport. Mm-hmm. Or it's just, like, imagine if you had something else to do. Like, watch TV. You probably wouldn't have killed that lady that day, you know?
Well, I hope that's not the only thing standing in between.
But
someone committing murder.
I just think it's an easy intervention. Just kidding. Yeah, take everything that I say with a grain of salt, everyone.
Guys, if you have the urge to murder someone, just put on some Netflix.
Yeah, like, watch, you know,
Bob's Burgers.
Watch something lighthearted. Put some Schitt's Creek on, you know, Parks and Rec. Just chill. You know, don't. Just don't murder. Like,
just
simple.
Do literally almost anything but that.
Yeah.
Just eat some cookies. I don't know.
Exactly.
We solved crime. We did it. We took care of it.
So, yeah. So, the case was super sensationalized. And Edith seemed to kind of be enjoying the publicity that she was getting. Because I do believe, like, in her heart of hearts, she believes that she was a witness to her husband's murder, not an accomplice. And so I think in her mind, it's like, well, I'm getting all of this attention and I know I didn't do it and there's no way they can convict me. And so she just kind of liked the publicity. And so she ended up insisting on testifying because, you know, it would get her more publicity.
Bad call. Yeah.
Yeah, very bad call. And so exactly what her lawyers were afraid of happening. And her testimony ended up being, quote, damning. And so the prosecutors basically caught her either in, like, a series of, like, lies or just inconsistencies. And I think those were more specifically related to the affair. And I think, like, it's not surprising when someone has already been lying for, you know, a year plus about a specific thing. Mm-hmm. For, I think to some degree, like, to maintain a lie like that, you do have to kind of start convincing yourself that the lie is the truth to some degree. And so I think asking about a lot of those details about the affair, she didn't have straightforward answers to it. And
yeah,
I also
it's
think
it's just gonna
make
you look unsavory.
Exactly.
It's just make you look bad.
Exactly. And so I think that was part of it as well. And so already being able to catch her in a series of lies obviously does worse to her character and her testimony. In terms of her demeanor, she came off a little flirtatious. She seemed to have a lot of, like, self-pity, like a little less concern, I guess, about now that her husband is dead.
Yeah, but, like, she wasn't sad enough.
Yeah, I mean, she was.
Which is the thing that people get called out for.
So she was, but she also still had a lot of, like, pity for herself. Like, look at the situation that I'm in now, you know? And then they also felt like she was a little melodramatic, which I just think is sexism. I'm like, I don't, like, maybe she was.
Just died.
Yeah, I'm like, maybe.
Was murdered in front of her.
Yeah, exactly.
What's an appropriate reaction to that? Oh my gosh.
And so in all, she just made, like, a really bad impression on the judge and on the jury. And so then she ended up getting, like, questioned about, basically they pull out specific, like, passages from her letters to Frederick. And they would be like, what was the meaning of, you know, blah, blah, blah. And she a lot of times would just be like, I have no idea. And again, I think that relates back to both not, especially since she is liking the publicity and some of the publicity was kind of a little bit in her favor to some degree. Like, you know, they're coming after this woman, not wanting to get negative publicity in that regard. And then also, again, she has been lying for, you know, a year or two at this point about this affair. And so, I don't know, I just feel like she's not in the mind space when it comes to the affair to even tell the truth. And so, anyway, eventually, like, after the trial, her lawyers actually said that if it wasn't for Edith's vanity and arrogance, that she would have actually had a great shot at being acquitted of the murder of her husband. But unfortunately, that's not what happened. And so her testimony ended up basically, like, negating the testimonies of, like, her neighbors who, like, her neighbors either saw the attack or heard it. And they testified, they were like, no, she was screaming for this person to stop. Like it was, like, cries of, you know, horror and all of these things, which painted her in a good light. Like, if somebody was, you know, complicit in this, you could expect that they might have had a different, like, reaction maybe, and that they wouldn't be actively screaming for help before, you know, because somebody could have stopped it, you know? And I don't, like, these aren't words that I have written. Okay, so also her testimony also kind of negated the statements of the police officers who had actually arrived on scene. And so those testimonies from the officers, again, were actually in favor of Edith. They were like, no, the woman that I saw that day, she was in a genuine state of shock. She was devastated and in disbelief. It was almost like she was incoherent, looking at her husband's body, like, oh God, why did he do it? I never wanted him to do it. And again, if she was complicit, why would she have named her lover?
Right.
Like, it could have been traced back to her. Anyway, so throughout the trial, Frederick continually stated that Edith didn't know of his plans. And so his justification or reasoning for that was that day he actually didn't intend to murder Percy. He was just staying kind of outside of, like, on their route home. Like, he knew they weren't home, and so he was just like near their house hiding, and his plan was actually just to confront Percy and like threaten him and like force him to like acknowledge that this woman is not in love with you, divorce her so I can be with her. And so, like, I mean, I'm the first person who's gonna say, like, if you brought a weapon, I believe your intention was to use said weapon. But again, we are talking about a hothead teenager, like, who has already been described as very, like, impulsive. And so, according to Frederick, he said that when he came out and was, like, confronting Percy, like, before he could even really say anything, Percy, like, reacted in defense. He reacted aggressively. And I don't think Percy's wrong for that. If somebody jumps out in front of me and I'm with, like, you know, my partner, like, I may feel this need to defend. And so once Percy reacted that way, Frederick says that he lost his temper, and that's when he decided to use the knife. And then he ran off after that. He was adamant that even in those letters and any conversations, that Edith made no suggestion to him that he should kill Percy. And when they did ask him about the letters and what Edith had written about, like, you know, the light bulbs and poison, he said that he had never believed that Edith had actually attempted to harm Percy. He believed that she wrote about the poison and the light bulbs as, like, just kind of her vivid imagination. And he also kind of cited, like, look at the other, she wrote about, like, the books that she was reading. So, like, look at, you know, some of those narratives and, like, what they were talking about. Like, they were, this was just an imagination fueled, especially by some of these novels. And that a lot of times the way she was writing the novels was her viewing herself in some way as, like, one of those fictional characters. And see,
well, yeah, it's not illegal to wish someone would die.
Yeah. And so it was being written more in, like, a narrative sense and not, like, an actual account of life. And see, again, if she had television, she wouldn't need to be writing stories. Just kidding. We clearly have authors today. And so, despite the only evidence of Edith's possible involvement being the letters, on December 11th, 1922, the jury found both Frederick and Edith guilty. And they both were sentenced to death by hanging.
What?
Yep. Insane. I, like, yeah. I think it's...
I don't think either of them warranted that at all, but especially not Edith.
Yeah, I feel like the punishment does not fit the crime here at all. Like, not even close. I wouldn't even say life imprisonment would be appropriate for this case, especially not for Edith. Like, maybe give her a couple years if you really feel like it, but yeah, I felt like it was insane. And so once the, like, verdict and sentencing was read, understandably, Edith became, like, hysterical. Like, she lost it and was screaming in the court. Like, she could not believe that it didn't work out in her favor. And again, I think that does speak to what her lawyers would later say about her vanity and arrogance. Like, she just like, there was no realm of possibility in her mind that, like, they could convict her. Right. And so perhaps a little bit of, like, humility could have gone a long way for her. And again, after the verdict was read, Frederick, he started screaming loudly and protesting that Edith was innocent. Like, you can't convict her. And so throughout her imprisonment, while awaiting execution, Edith was often hysterical. Like, she would just cry and, like, just be in just, like, an emotional kind of rage or panic about her impending execution, or she was just in disbelief that she was about to be executed. Her parents wrote to the king. I just think it's funny. Anyway, her parents wrote to the king hoping that he would overturn the death sentence. They tried to appeal to the courts, and then Frederick also gave more testimony that Edith was innocent, but nothing worked in Edith's favor. And then they had their execution set for January 9th, 1923, so the following month.
Don't tell me they actually executed her.
Let me read my case. Okay. So that morning, Edith screamed and cried and begged for her life, but there was no reprieve for her. Answers your question. And so just before 9 a.m. that morning, they administered a sedative to her and gave her brandy to calm her nerves because, again, understandably, she was hysterical. It actually took four people to drag her from the building to outside where the hanging would take place, which also hanging people is like
the 20s?
Like, what the actual heck?
Maybe the 1820s.
Gruesome. I don't understand. I mean, in my opinion,
all gruesome.
Yeah,
right.
like the electric, all of it. It's awful. And so she, they took four people to drag her out. And so right before like going up to like where it was taking place, she actually collapsed and she wasn't able to actually walk herself up to the gallows. And so they strapped her, they had to carry her up there, and then they strapped her into like a chair so that she would like sit. And they put a white hood over her head and they placed a noose around her neck. Once the clock hit 9 o'clock, the floor beneath her opened and she died. At another prison just miles away, Frederick was executed at the exact same time. After the execution, an autopsy of Percy's body was conducted, and it showed no signs that he'd ever been fed glass or any type of poison, both of which the medical examiner believed would have likely still have been detectable in his body since the event like allegedly would have happened in that past year, unless she were somehow able to get access to like one of those more particular types of poisons that were undetectable, but they believe that that was also
likely. Wait, they did the autopsy after they killed her?
Yeah.
So what was the point of doing the autopsy then?
I don't know.
Or why wouldn't you do it before?
I don't know.
This is so frustrating.
Yeah.
Why would you do this to me?
Sorry. And so Edith was buried at the prison, which was, I guess, the rule or how it was done back then. And her mother, Ethel, requested that her daughter be buried at their family plot, but that request was denied.
So come on. That's literally the least you could do.
Yeah. So instead, Ethel repeatedly requested to visit Edith's gravesite at the prison, but those requests were also denied. So she was not even allowed to, you know, pay her respects at her daughter's grave. Ethel died in 1983. So, 60 years after her daughter was executed. And her dying wish was that Edith be exhumed and her body buried beside her at their family grave. In 2018... Ethel's dying wish was finally fulfilled, and Edith's remains were laid to rest in her parents' grave, 95 years after her father kissed his daughter for the last time and promised her, "You will be home at last tomorrow night." which was the night before she was executed.
That's terrible.
Yeah. And so since her trial and execution, I've even seen like articles written relatively recently, just kind of discussing just some of the nuances, I guess, of what was going on, but then also exactly what role sexism, the marginalization of women and different things like that kind of played in why Ethel was convicted and executed. And so a lot of the narrative, I feel like, has been more in defense of Edith, with many believing that Edith's conviction and execution was due in large part to sexism. Basically, you know, she was executed because she was a woman who had an extramarital affair. Mm-hmm. And it just so happened that the man that she had an affair with made the poor decision to, you know, murder her husband. And it's, you know, her feminine wiles must have driven him to that point, because a man can't clearly be responsible solely for his own actions. I read, there was a quote by, her name is Sue Sims, and so her husband Graham is the great nephew of Edith's brother, so just, you know, family, who wrote, or who said that she was innocent. And I think the way she describes the trial is actually very accurate, in which she says it was a trial of a woman's morality. And I think
absolutely.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. They felt that she had done something immoral by falling for another man and having an affair. I think the most damning part was that it was just written on paper. That she, just the fact that it was, that she had all of these love letters clearly saying that she loved this man, mm-hmm. I think just worked very, very much not in her favor, but for whatever reason, they chose to kind of sensationalize that against her. There's also some, like, I guess, conjecture, speculation that Edith was actually pregnant at the time of the execution, because she had been refusing food while she was imprisoned, but she was still gaining weight.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it caused, the increased weight gain over that period of time caused her to, like, hemorrhage at her execution, which is not super likely. But, you know, when you're pregnant, you have kind of a lot more blood, like, running through your veins. As far as I know, they didn't do an autopsy or anything, obviously, because they knew how she died. That is the case of Edith Thompson and Frederick Bywaters. It's a very disappointing one. I just felt like I really wanted to do it, because I just feel like it was an inappropriate conviction.
Yes,
she's guilty of cheating on her husband. And maybe in the 19 whatevers that could have been illegal. I don't know.
But also, like, it's still relevant today, where someone's character might be in question when they're, like, on trial. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they committed a crime. If they're just not a great person, you know, if they're cheating on their partner, doesn't necessarily mean, you know, I feel like there are probably more recent cases that you can point to where someone ends up being convicted of something they didn't do just because of the fact that they're not a great person or didn't have a great history. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I think I can't speak for other countries, but I know, especially in the United States, I feel like in a lot of cases people get put on trial in the court of public opinion first. Mm-hmm. And I think that most of the time doesn't work in people's favor. It has a negative impact on them, even if you just look at, like, cases of people who get murdered, like, use, like, Trayvon Martin, like, a kid, but because he posted a picture that, you know, because he posted a picture that you wouldn't expect, I guess, a, like, 15 or 16, like, yeah, I think it was 15, like, year old kid, mm-hmm. then that means he was guilty. And then I think they also did it with Casey Anthony. And, you know, regardless of your opinion on whether or not she did it, like, most of it was, look at these pictures of her at the club. Look at these pictures of her with these bottles of, like, whatever. This clearly means...
But that was after she did the murder.
Well, it was after... I think they used, like, pictures of her, like, while she was... Like, while Kaylee was alive as well. And then also, they're like, and after she also was going to clubs and stuff. And so, just to kind of paint a picture of, like, clearly, because she went to a club, she's a negligible... Or negligent mother.
Moms can go to the club, okay? Yeah, if you don't think I'm going to be going to the club, I don't even go to the club now. I don't know what I'm saying.
But yeah, and I mean, in this, like, obviously a lot of people feel like, you know, she did do it. But still, it's just, it's unfortunate that a lot of those things are taken into account before hard evidence, in fact.
Or... this freaking, what I was talking about a couple weeks ago, I think, of the case of Richard Jewell, where he was, he saved so many people from this bomb in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, mm-hmm. and the FBI pinned it on him.
Yeah.
And everyone was convinced that he did it. And, like, in reality, all he did was just save a bunch of people's lives, and then his life got, like, completely ruined for a period of time.
Yeah.
So
it's highly, highly unfortunate. I do think it's one of those things that will never be fixed, unfortunately, but mm-hmm. we are where we are.
What you gonna do? Okay. So mine's a bit different, but still falls into the couple's theme. But see, And I would love for people to, like, give recommendations kind of this way, where we can both kind of go in our own direction. I think that's really cool. But so I'm going to be talking about a couple that was compared to be a modern day Bonnie and Clyde, although I strongly disagree with that comparison. We'll see what you think as we're going forward.
Cool.
So this case started in September 28th of 2015. A man wearing a faded red plaid button-up shirt and thinning blonde hair entered a Big Y world-class market on Center Street in Ludlow, Massachusetts. I have no idea what a Big Y world-class market is. I assume it's a type of grocery store. We only have, like, Wegmans and, like, Star Markets and Stop and Shops, but who knows? So he implied he had a gun, but no weapon was seen. The teller gave the man an undetermined amount of money, and he left the store. A person outside saw him get into the back seat of a dark SUV with an unknown Massachusetts dealer plate. The man would later be identified as Joseph Carrier, and the woman driving the car was his wife, Jenny. The car, it turned out, was a 2015 Buick Encore and had been stolen from the dealership in Quincy where Jenny had worked. Jenny worked at the Prime Buick GMC in Hanover, but had called in sick over the summer, and then she never showed up to work ever again after calling out. The first robbery marked the start of a month-long multi-state spree of robberies that would span... That's so redundant. Multi-state robbery that would span five states and end in a police chase and crash. I don't know if I wrote later on that there was a crash, but I guess maybe. Anyway, I will say that I had to piece together information from so many different articles. So if there's a little bit of inconsistency or something doesn't quite line up, I did
not
my
our
best.
Problem.
I had to cherry pick a lot of things. Part of it might be my fault, but part of it also might be from my sources. So if you really want to double check all, like, the 12 sources I went to, feel free and call me out, whatever. But Jenny and Joseph were likened to a modern day Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie and Clyde obviously are perhaps one of the most famous or infamous couples in American history. Bonnie helped Clyde escape from jail after he was arrested for burglary. This was back in the 1920s, 1930s, by the way. And at the end of their crime spree, it was suspected that they were responsible for 13 murders and numerous robberies. So not only were they robbing places, but they were also killers. And their spree ended in a shootout on May 23rd, 1934 in Louisiana, where they were shot to death death by officers during an ambush. So, like I said earlier, I'm not sure it's fair to compare Jenny and Joseph to this famous criminal couple.
Yeah.
Jenny and Joseph were addicted to heroin. Now, heroin is an opioid drug made from morphine, which is taken from the pod of various opium poppy plants. So heroin can be injected, snorted, sniffed, or smoked. And it works by entering the brain and attaching to opioid receptors on cells located in many areas, but especially those involved in pain and pleasure. And it can affect our heart rate, our sleeping, and our breathing. So we don't know how Jenny and Joseph started using, but in many cases, prescription opioid pain medicines like OxyContin and Vicodin open the door to heroin use. The short-term effects of heroin can involve unpleasant sensations like dry mouth, nausea, vomiting, clouded mental functioning, and going on the nod, so going in between a state of consciousness or semi-consciousness. I think, like, if you've ever seen a video of someone nodding out, that's what it looks like. But people also report feeling a rush or a strong surge of pleasure or euphoria. So using heroin over longer periods of time may result in insomnia, collapsed veins, infection, mental disorders like depression, and antisocial personality disorder, just to name a few. Heroin can also be mixed with certain additives like sugar, starch, powdered milk, and this can lead to clogs in blood vessels, causing permanent damage to certain organs. Sharing needles or impaired judgment from using heroin could also increase a person's risk of contracting infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis. And there's always a risk of overdosing on heroin. So when people overdose, their breathing can slow or sometimes stop altogether, interfering with the amount of oxygen that reaches the brain. This is called hypoxia, and there are short-term and long-term effects. It can induce a coma or result in permanent brain damage, or it can result, obviously, in death. So if someone you know is struggling with addiction, naloxone is a medicine that can be used to treat opioid overdose, but it needs to be used right away at the time of the overdose. So it works by binding to the opioid receptors, blocking the effects of heroin and other drugs. And this drug has been essential in saving many people's lives and preventing overdoses. And in some states, you can get naloxone from a pharmacist without a prescription from a doctor. So I'm going to include a link for the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's Opioid Overdose Prevention Toolkit in our podcast description. So, you know, if you have never encountered someone struggling with an addiction or aren't aware of the effects of repeated drug use on the mind or body, it can be easy to blame the individual or think, like, why don't people just stop using drugs? Like, it's clear that just say no is not something that works, which is why I believe it's more important to focus on harm reduction in these situations. So very pro naloxone. You know, if you or someone you know is suffering with addiction, just having that around can make the difference between life or death. Very important thing. And so heroin is a highly addictive substance. When you use more regularly, you start to build a tolerance, so you need to use more of the same drug to experience the same high you were getting before. It's not fun to have an addiction. Yeah. I think that, like, I just wanted to list, like, all these negative effects that come along with it. That, like, it's not just that people are able to just quit or it's a matter of willpower at a certain point. Yeah. Heroin withdrawal can start just a few hours after the drug was last taken. And withdrawal symptoms include restlessness, muscle and bone pain, sleep problems, diarrhea, vomiting, cold flashes, and uncontrollable leg movements. Like, just take a second and imagine the sickest that you've ever been. And what if you knew you were able to take something to feel better? Like, you knew, like, oh, if I just take this, like, all of the experiences of terribleness will go away. Like, just, I'm thinking just now after my second COVID shot, how horrible I felt, which, like, wasn't even bad at all, was not really that bad. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm dying, oh my God. I was like, part of it too is that, like, I have anxiety. So, like, when I start to feel bad, it spirals out of control. So I was, like, actually starting to have a panic attack on top of not feeling great. fun things anyway. But so, like in that moment, you just are so desperate. Like think if you've ever gotten like food poisoning, you're mm-hmm. like so desperate. If you're like, oh my God, if I could like take a pill and this would go away, you would probably do it. You're like functioning, your thought processing is impaired because you're just so overwhelmed by how terrible you feel.
Yeah. And, you know, for kind of in favor of withdrawing, there are, you know, medical options. So buprenorphine, naloxone treatment and, or Suboxone, can help you withdraw and like mitigate those withdrawal symptoms. So you'll be more or less fine. And then throughout the kind of 3-day withdrawal period, or even longer, and then continue to do treatment, with buprenorphine so that you, you know, kind of get off of, or I guess taper off of opioids. So just an option you can,
right,
you know, something to consider if you or anyone who's listening, knows anyone or needs it yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I think the efficacy of medication assisted treatment is something that should be highlighted more. And mm-hmm. I think sometimes it's looked down upon in a negative light. You know, if you need to be on like methadone or some other medication for the rest of your life in order to avoid using, then absolutely, like, do that. That is a better, like I said, kind of harm reduction is like obviously the best case scenario would be just say no, like don't use, but obviously that's not realistic in most situations. Yeah. So how can we reduce harm to people? And in these cases, medication assisted treatment, I think, has been linked to higher less death from overdose. So
yeah, it has.
Whatever has the results, I stand behind and say we should encourage more people to do that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it also, getting it increases likelihood of staying in substance use treatment as opposed mm-hmm. to doing some other type of, plan, I guess, just going either cold turkey or tapering yourself. So, woo.
Right, right. So, yeah. And part of what I wanted to do is highlight kind of the side effects to know that someone who's going through heroin withdrawal can be in a not so rational place. Also, long-term use can affect our decision-making, behavior control, and our responses to stressful situations. So again, it's not just mind over matter when it comes to quitting drugs. There are also so many other factors involved, which like in a perfect world we would have. And I think that in this case, maybe these robberies might not have happened if there was less judgment in the medical field, if they were able to get the help they needed. Who's to say, you know? Really don't know much about like their backgrounds or anything, but I think it's important to consider that if they were able to get treatment, if there was kind of like a judgment-free zone that they could go to, then it might not have ended up this way. So the Ludlow robbery took place on September 28th, and the next robbery occurred on October 9th in West Salisbury, Pennsylvania, at a bank branch located inside of a Walmart. And then after that, they ended up in Palm Coast, Florida. So on like going from Massachusetts to Florida, I think it's like a 16-hour drive. I looked it up. So they were kind of all over the place. But so that was on October 12th. And Joseph entered a Wells Fargo and told the teller, "I have a gun. Just give me your big bills." And he left the bank with $800, which like nowadays, I don't think you get very much money from robbing banks or like convenience stores or anything like that. Like to me, it's just not, not worth it.
Unless you're doing Money Heist or what they did in Money Heist, you're probably not going to get a lot.
What did they do in Money Heist?
So they basically occupy it's a show set in Spain. So they occupy what I think is the equivalent of like the mint or wherever they print money. And they take it over and they make it seem like their plan is just to steal the money, but they actually start staying there for a while. and you realize that what they're actually doing is just printing more money.
Like, oh, dang.
That way, the bills wouldn't be able to be traced because they haven't been put in. Yeah, and so they're just printing, and they have hostages, like, they have the hostages printing money, and they get the hostages, like, on their side, because they're like, how many millions do you want? Like, we can just print it.
Oh, gosh. Or, yeah, that's, so, like, the Ocean's 11 movie, where they're like, we're going to go on the night where this big boxing match is happening, so the casino has this much money. Yeah. Rob a casino instead of a bank, guys. No, I'm kidding. Don't rob anywhere.
I'm gonna cut that out. I don't want you to go to prison. if they can hang like Edith for
it was a joke, guys. It was a joke. No, oh my god, now you're making me scared. No, I'm actually not. It's fine. Don't rob places, guys. So on October 16th, just before 1 p.m. on a Friday, Joseph entered a Bank of America branch and demanded money from a teller. This was in Aberdeen, Maryland, I believe is where Aberdeen is located, question mark. So he was seen entering a dark car after he left, presumably driven by Jenny. And at the time, the police were urging the public, they were like aware that there was kind of this spree happening, and they said, hey, public, call 911 if you see the couple. Don't try to make contact with them. We don't know what state they're in. And now, obviously, they were wanted in Massachusetts, Florida, and Maryland. So an Aberdeen police sergeant, C. William Ryber, was interviewed by the Boston Herald, and he said, I don't want to be the bearer of bad news, but I'm not expecting it to end with our bank. Not to sound cliche, but they're a modern-day Bonnie and Clyde. They're robbing banks and using the funds to support some sort of illicit activity. So I have a different interview with a different police person that the opinions between the two are clearly different, and I think just goes to show the importance of like how people might be portrayed in the media is based, like, a police sergeant is saying oh, they're Bonnie and Clyde. Like, no, they're not. They didn't murder anybody. And it's just clearly not the same. But by making that comparison, I think that that was an irresponsible thing to do, especially as a police sergeant. But so the carriers, too, were traveling with a lot of dogs, which I think just goes to show that it was just kind of erratic behavior.
Yeah.
So Ryber believed that they may be spotted very soon after the robbery due to the fact that the dogs would need to be let out quite often in the car. You know, you don't want your dogs, like, pooping everywhere. That would smell terrible. So it required frequent stops along the road. And in fact, one of the neighbors in Quincy had noticed the couple was gone in the first place in August because the dogs were no longer around. They were well known in their area because they had between 7 and 14 dogs. Bit of a range there. But after seeing their faces on wanted posters, the neighbor told CBS Boston, I'm shocked. I shouldn't be shocked. I suppose nothing in the world would shock me anymore. Which is like, interesting. Are you still there?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm literally just like nodding my head. I'm like, okay.
Okay. Okay. I just want to make sure I didn't lose you. Because I do that all the time and I just keep going. I get too into it. So finally, the carriers were arrested after robbing a Citizens Bank in Wilmington, Delaware. Joseph entered the bank and implied again that he had a gun, and he took approximately $2,400 and fled the scene in the Buick driven by Jenny. An alert was put on the police radio, and the Delaware State Police saw the Buick on the highway. Jenny was driving the car and did not stop when she saw the cops were tailing her. She reached speeds upwards of 100 miles per hour. And the couple was arrested when the chase came to an end just after the exit to the Philadelphia International Airport. So during the robbery spree, the couple's family had been cooperating with the investigation. Relatives had helped the police track down the couple because they wanted them to get treatment. At the time of the robberies, the couple was also experiencing homelessness, which I think is another factor. You know, if you don't have somewhere safe to go to, if you don't have somewhere safe to be, that can result in compromising like your safety and the safety of others. Another huge problem that can play a role in you know, crime. So at the time of the arrest, the couple had 7 dogs with them. But one of the dogs escaped during the arrest and ran across 7 lanes of traffic. And they never found him or her.
I hope someone found him or her and loved him or her forever.
I did put that. I said, we hope the little pup was picked up and found a loving family. So
great minds.
The dogs that they had were Brussels Griffins, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with that breed of dog.
No, but
they're
look it up.
They're like the little ones, and they look like Ewoks from Star Wars, which I'm not sure you'll get that reference either, because I don't know if you've seen Star Wars
Is an Ewok what Chewbacca was?
No, an Ewok are these like little teddy bear guys.
What a funny looking dog.
Yeah. They look interesting, but they're small. So if they were like driving around with 2 adult dogs and like 5 little puppies, it wouldn't take up that much room in your car. You know, it wouldn't be. And like, clearly they like really cared for these dogs. They took them with them. And the dogs, the adults were named Olive and Wesley. And then they had the puppies. I think Brussels Griffins are like slightly ugly, but like, I also have an ugly dog, but I think she's cute.
I think the thing about
some people think she's ugly.
I think the thing about most dogs is like, if they're ugly, they're usually so cute, so ugly that they're cute.
Right. See, like I hated small dogs for the longest time, and then my family ended up getting like a small dog, and she's like one of the ones with an underbite, which like some of them can be like raw ugly, but like I think she's cute, but Evan disagrees.
I don't like the dogs with underbite. I'm like, you look weird.
But she's so cute, and her teeth are so crooked. She looks so ugly. I love it. I would literally die for her.
When I got Ollie, my friend, she had a puggle, so pug beagle mix, and we were just like looking at them, and one of us like looked at Ollie's teeth, and she was like, oh my god, they're so perfect compared to like Diesel, which is her dog, and she was just like, see, that's the difference between a mutt and a purebred. And I'm like, yes. Like,
both of our dogs are mutts, and Peyton has nice teeth. I think it's more of like a smushed face dog thing.
Yeah.
Of like their teeth are just like totally jammed in there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Poor puppies. Anyway, so they had these Brussels Griffin dogs, little Ewok dogs. So the dogs ended up being taken to a shelter. So hopefully those dogs too found nice loving homes. So like I said, the family had worked with the Ludlow police and detective. So this is a different detective who seems to be more informed about mental health and things like that. So Detective Sergeant Louis Tulick he discouraged the media from comparing the couple to Bonnie and Clyde and said Bonnie and Clyde actually killed people and were extremely violent. I don't think that's a proper term to describe this. And he said of the carriers were very troubled, very sick, and were feeding a habit. They weren't doing this for thrills. They weren't doing this for profit. Yeah. And after the arrest, the detective sergeant spoke to the family, saying they were extremely relieved. I'm not sure many people in the family got a lot of sleep in the last 30 days, so when the robberies were occurring, and hopefully they slept better last night. He also said, in reference to the carriers, they're going to get their help, though probably through the criminal justice system, and they're going to have to answer for what they've done. So he doesn't, you know, just entirely excuse their behavior, saying, you know, they did do things wrong. You know, they did, the people who were on the receiving end of their robbery, you know, it's traumatic to think someone has a gun and that your life is in danger, and that's something that could potentially affect you for the rest of your life. So I think he found a nice balance of not excusing what they did, but also recognizing that they're sick, that they are, you know, experiencing a mental illness. I think addiction is also like a mental illness too, is a physical illness, you know, it's an illness of our brains, and then addiction too has the added aspect of having those physical withdrawals and affecting, you know, our judgment and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the couple was charged with bank robbery and aiding and abetting bank robbery for the Wilmington incident. The stories that I found didn't really follow up beyond that as to like where they are, what they ended up being charged with. So, I mean, we can assume that they're in jail or in prison. Mm-hmm. Hopefully, and if that's the case, you know, they're probably not getting any type of adequate treatment for their addiction, unfortunately.
Yeah, other than just probably limited access to.
Right.
Because you can still get drugs in prison, apparently, so.
Right. But I know they do, in some prisons, they do, like, groups and stuff. They have, like, at my graduate program, people went into prisons to do therapy. So it is possible that they might have access to mental health care, but also I think that being in prison is very damaging to your mental health in the first place. So who's to say that it was, you know, they probably weren't getting the care that they needed, but at the very least, you're right, like having limited access to drugs, and hopefully, you know, once they get out, they're able to access the care they need and continue in their sobriety and kind of get back on track.
Yeah.
That's the case of the carriers. The not modern day Bonnie and Clyde.
I 100% agree with you. No, like, definitely not.
Like, that police person that said that was just a weenie.
Unless, like, all he knew about Bonnie and Clyde was that they were a couple that robbed things.
Maybe.
Like, but even
but
then.
But that guy's, you're ignorant, and you shouldn't be making those comparisons.
Exactly. Like, educate yourself, buddy. I mean, it's sad. Like, you see stuff like that happen all the time, and it's, yes, you're wrong for committing a crime, but in a lot of ways, it's the symptom of a larger disease.
Right.
And so it's disappointing because it is, like, you know, it is a symptom of a literal disease, but in this case, because it's not necessarily victimless, it's a crime, obviously.
Well, yeah, it'd be one thing if we had a more perfect system where people had access to treatment, where there were, you know, kind of non-judgmental spaces they could enter, and if in that case, you know, people still chose to inflict harm on others, then absolutely, but you're right. Our system is not anywhere near perfect, and, you know, who's to say how much that contributed to what ended up happening.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, definitely.
I just hope the little doggy's okay.
Our music is the track Wasteland by Joseph McDade. His Patreon and our podcast sources will be linked in the podcast description below. Any mistakes are entirely our own, so check out our wonderful sources for the most accurate information about these cases.
We talk about some tough subject matter on our show. If you or someone you love is in need of support, please reach out to the Crisis Text Line by texting HOME to 741-741. They are available 24/7 and will connect you with a trained crisis counselor.
You can also reach the National Domestic Violence Hotline by calling 1-800-799-7233. Thank you so much for listening to our show. Join us next week for another episode of
Pink Collar, a true crime podcast.